I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. 1 million minutes of news video from old newsreels have been uploaded to YouTube, creating a massive visual encyclopedia that would take you 2 years to watch. Midday culture commentator Sherry Parks talks about the significance of such view-on-demand history in the second hour of today's show. We'll also get Sherry's take on the Trump phenomenon as the outspoken billionaire heads for tonight's Republican presidential debate. Up front, a conversation with Michael Pinard, a University of Maryland law professor with a lot on his mind as the anniversary of the shooting death of Michael Brown approaches. Brown's death in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri, sparked protests against police use of force. It spilled into the streets of Baltimore following the death of Freddie Gray. First, the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to the Midday Show. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. This Sunday will mark the one-year anniversary of the fatal shooting of Michael Brown, the unarmed black teenager, by a white police officer in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri. The death of Michael Brown sparked weeks of protests and sometimes violent confrontations between protesters and police in Ferguson, and it contributed to a growing national debate over police use of force. Darren Wilson, the police officer who shot Michael Brown, was not charged with any wrongdoing. He left the Ferguson Police Department and now is unemployed and living in seclusion on the outskirts of St. Louis. That's according to an in-depth piece about him in The New Yorker. It has been a whirlwind year for American society in the wake of Michael Brown's death, the chokehold death of Eric Garner on Staten Island in New York, and in Baltimore, the death of Freddie Gray from injuries sustained while in police custody here. Six Baltimore police officers were charged in Gray's death and are expected to stand trial this fall. Our guest this hour has been thinking about all of this a lot and returns to our show today to share his thoughts. University of Maryland law professor Michael Pinard has for years studied the effect of the criminal justice system on Baltimore's low-income residents, particularly its black citizens, right down to the street level. He believes that what has been exposed in Ferguson and Baltimore are the ways in which minor crimes flood our criminal courts and saddle people with criminal records and financial obligations that stand in the way of jobs, housing, and life's opportunities. In a new essay for the Howard University Law Journal, Michael Pinard looks at the similarities between Baltimore and Ferguson with regard to criminal justice. The essay is called Poor Black and Wanted, wanted in quotes. Welcome back to Midday, Michael. Nice to have you back on the show.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
I note from sort of the epilogue of your, the end notes of your essay, that you had started working on this piece for the Law Journal before Freddie Gray was killed and or died.
Correct.
I said was killed, didn't I? He died in police custody. So that made you want to do a comparison piece, I guess, or was it? It wasn't originally a comparison piece.
It was originally. Yeah. So when the Baltimore Sun, well, first of all, you know, Ferguson, when Michael Brown died, I think what it caused many of us to do was reflect, to think about our respective jurisdictions, and the ways in which our jurisdictions are similar. That is, that the underlying conditions that can lead to an event such as that are similar and different. And so, you know, you look at Ferguson and Baltimore, very similar demographics in terms of the percent of African Americans who live in both cities. So Ferguson, Missouri, is a much smaller city. It's a city suburb, 21,000 people. 67% of the population is African American. Baltimore, obviously a major city, 63% of the residents are African American. In both cities, about 25% live under the poverty line. And in both cities, African-Americans are really wedded to the criminal justice system. And so those were the similarities I was interested in exploring. And then last September, when the Baltimore Sun revealed that Baltimore at that point had paid $5.7 million to settle these police lawsuits or in judgments,
Lawsuits against the police over excessive force.
Right, over excessive force. that we had similar conditions, if you will, with regard to the criminal justice system and with regard to police community relations, as well as with regard to abuse. And so that's what made me think about the similarities. We actually did a program at the School of Social Work around these issues last fall in light of Ferguson, where we talked about some underlying statistics in Baltimore and in Ferguson. And this article was done mm-hmm. when Freddie Gray was when Freddie Gray had that situation that resulted in his death.
You say in the piece, Mr. Gray's tragic death made the similarities between Ferguson and Baltimore even more stark.
Correct.
And distressing. As with Michael Brown's death in Ferguson, Mr. Gray's death angered and saddened Baltimore residents, particularly
right.
those who live in the city's black communities, where poverty is concentrated and generations of residents have relationships with Baltimore's police department and its criminal justice system that are marked by abuse, frustration, fear, disgust, anger, routine, and familiarity.
Right.
Yes, Freddie Gray was very familiar with the police and
mm-hmm.
vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
During this hour of the show, we're going to hear some things from Michael Pinard. This is a note to our listeners about how the system works,
mm-hmm.
About how people are kept in the system much longer than maybe they should be, about the costs that are forced on people who have, served time, have earned probation or parole,
right.
Things like that, that weigh heavily on people who've been through the system here and in Ferguson. So please be listening for that. And if you have any comments or questions as we move along in our conversation with Michael Pinard, just give me a ring. 410-662-8780 is our number, and you can address a comment or question by email to midday@wypr.org. So, Michael, I want to go to a story that appeared in the New York Times just yesterday or the day before about Ferguson because of
mm-hmm.
the anniversary that's approaching.
Right.
I want to read a couple of things here and then get your comments because it relates to the essay that you wrote for the Law Journal. Improvements in Ferguson are undeniable, the Times reports. The local, state, and federal authorities point to new programs and new laws enacted since the unrest in Ferguson, including increased funds for job training and college assistance, and legislation lowering the percentage of revenue Missouri cities can make from traffic fines and fees, described by Governor Jay Nixon as, quote, the most sweeping municipal court reform in state history. This gets right to it. Perhaps most significant, city leaders say they have revamped their municipal court system, replacing the longtime judge who sat there,
mm-hmm.
and two widely criticized practices, holding people in jail for days on minor offenses when they could not post bond, mm-hmm. and piling on new failure-to-appear charges against those who miss court. So let's talk about those, Ferguson and Baltimore,
right.
Because this is where people get stuck in the system. Actually, you use that word in
right.
your essay.
So, right. So, one of the most glaring aspects of Ferguson, what we all learned in the light of Ferguson, was the extent to which these low-level municipal violations funded the town, funded the municipality, and the extent to which these were budgeted items. Right, they expected to collect $500,000 more from fines than they did from property taxes. So this was very much embedded within the revenue stream of Ferguson. And so you just mentioned some reforms in Ferguson. By far the biggest reforms in Ferguson in light of Michael Brown's death have been sort of the revamping of the municipal court system that you just mentioned. So, for instance, they abolished some fees. They had these warrant recall fees that they abolished.
What's a warrant recall fee?
So in Ferguson, essentially, they have a warrant. The person's arrested, they recall the warrant, they would charge that person for recalling the warrant.
They would charge you
the person
a fee,
money
like, like 40, 50 bucks or
right,
something?
To actually recall the warrant, yes. So there was a fee. You had the warrant, and then to recall the warrant, people in Ferguson would charge. You had to pay money to have the warrant recalled.
What happens here, do you know, since we're doing this comparatively?
Well, we don't have the extent of fees that they have. I mean, Ferguson, I'm not going to say Ferguson's an outlier, but it might be an outlier in that regard. Certainly Baltimore, we don't fund the city as they did in Ferguson. So I'm not aware of a warrant recall fee. There are a host of other fees that I'm aware of.
Just so we understand how that works. So
right.
There's a warrant out for me.
Correct.
And I've become aware of it, right?
Correct.
It hasn't been acted on yet because the police haven't knocked on my door.
Right.
But I find out maybe from my parole officer or somebody
right.
that there's a warrant for
you
me.
You have a warrant you have to take care of.
Okay, so in
right.
Ferguson, if that was the case,
right.
it would cost me money to
correct. To recall the actual warrant. That is right.
to turn myself in, basically?
Well, the recall, once you turn yourself in, they can recall the warrant, and then hopefully the warrant will then go away. That would cost money. There was a recall fee for that.
So if you turn yourself in, there's no need for the warrant anymore, right?
Correct. And actually, if you're arrested, there's no need for the warrant either, right? You now have been detained.
So in Ferguson, they were charging people basically to turn themselves in.
Correct. Right.
All right. And now, then, in Baltimore, if you have an outstanding warrant, this even though it doesn't cost you to get a recall of it costs you in other ways. You point out in the article, for instance, when you go to look for a job, if there's an outstanding warrant, this is something you have to resolve, right?
Well, here's the situation, right? In both jurisdictions, individuals remain wedded to the criminal justice system because of warrants. So every day in Baltimore, we have approximately 40,000 warrants, right? For a range of issues. But many of my clients will have warrants. They didn't appear in court, all right? And we have warrants in Baltimore. It is not, you know, a rare occasion to find somebody with a warrant. They have no idea they have a warrant, right? That could be a warrant from 5 years ago, from 10 years ago. So it could pop up at any time.
A question about warrants, though. They're legitimate, are they not? I mean, if I fail to appear for a court case and there's a warrant issued by the judge and it's outstanding for, you know, I don't know, six months, a year, it's still a legitimate apparatus of the court, is it not?
Yes, but here's the issue. The issue to me is, number one, is we're very reflexive in how we use warrants. That is, a person fails to appear. We don't know why the person failed to appear. There's no attempt to contact the person. So, for instance, there's actually empirical data, studies that have shown, you know, if you call a person who fails to appear, they pick up the phone. Oh, wow, I need to go to court. My point is there are other ways to deal with the situations, even after you get a warrant. I mean, the problem with these warrants is once a person turns himself in or herself in, then you have the whole apparatus of the criminal justice system. You're detained, right? You go through central booking. There are other ways to deal with these issues.
And are you talking about minor crimes, people who are wanted?
I'm focusing on minor crime, right? This essay really focuses on relatively minor crimes. And so that's my point, is that these minor crimes actually across the country, they fuel the criminal justice system. Most of our debates and conversations are around the major crimes, and major crimes drive policy. But if you were to go into Wabash District Court, if you would go to any district court in Baltimore City, you will see droves and droves of people charged with minor crimes and how these minor crimes paralyze them.
And this includes traffic enforcement, right?
Correct.
In Ferguson, that was a big part of the municipal budget.
That was a huge part of it, right? Right, these traffic offenses.
In fact, I think you pointed out in your article here that a fiscal officer in Ferguson praised I'm looking for the reference here.
They celebrated
the city manager. Right. The city manager lauded the 44% increase in municipal court revenues from fiscal year 2010 to 2011, which was, quote, due to a more concentrated focus on traffic enforcement.
Right.
So in order to balance the budget, even have a surplus, they were sending the cops out to.
Again, this was a financial crutch for Ferguson. They relied on it. So what that means is that overwhelmingly, African-Americans are interfacing with the criminal justice system in Ferguson for relatively minor offenses, driving offenses, similar offenses. They remain stuck in the system, right? I mean, the thing that really struck home for me in Ferguson, when people are scared to go to court. Before, you know, this is well-known in Ferguson, right? I mean, we don't know about it. It takes Michael Brown being killed for us to know about it. But this is well-known in Ferguson. People are afraid to go to court because their poverty, they know, can result in their incarceration. It is, I cannot afford to pay these fees, right? Incarceration is then used as a weapon against me, right? I cannot get out of the system. So, you know, it's incredibly disturbing, problematic, unconstitutional. Use whatever adjective you want to use.
Okay, but what about this? Are you impressed with the speed with which the government reacted to the disturbances, the unrest in Ferguson, and these issues that surfaced because of it? The legislature, for instance, passed a bill to cap revenue from fines, bond forfeitures, and court costs from minor traffic violations at 12.5% of general revenue of the municipalities that comprise St. Louis County, which includes Ferguson.
Right.
And let me just finish there. And 20% for the we're going to turn the page. 20% for the remaining parts of Missouri. Said you have to cap this. You have to find some other way of raising revenue to run your government, your municipality besides this. I mean, this I mean, it's been a year. Would you say that's pretty good, considering this started with Michael Brown's tragic death a year ago?
Right. So impressed is, I would not use the word impressed. I will say that these reforms are well needed, right? Are absolutely necessary, and you know, hopefully there's a brighter day forward as a result of these reforms. I will say though that again, you know, I think look, the theme that we're seeing throughout the country now, in the conversations we're having now, right? The shame of it all is that people have to die for us to have these conversations, to learn about these conditions in other jurisdictions. I put this on me. It's a shame that it took Michael Brown to die for me to know about these underlying conditions in Ferguson, right? These are conditions that the folks they have lived with for generations. These are wellness, like Baltimore and Freddie Gray, right? We have all these conversations about the criminal justice system, about Sandtown, Winchester, vis-a-vis other neighborhoods in
poverty,
Baltimore City.
You all know, kinds of issues.
We don't need the Baltimore Sun to tell us this, right? But we need Freddie Gray to die for people to really sit around a table and think critically about how it got this far. So impressed is not the word I would use. I will say, though, that it takes an event like this. Obviously, all reforms, these reforms are positive developments, but it's a shame that it gets this far. The other thing, though, is that while we're capping these fees, right, think about just the mass criminalization of the folks in Ferguson who go into the system as a result of these minor offenses. And so there's a lot more work to be done.
Michael Pinard is our guest in this hour of the Midday Show here on WYPR, University of Maryland law professor, talking about an essay that he wrote for the Howard Law Journal called Poor Black and Wanted in quotes, Criminal Justice in Ferguson and Baltimore. Short break here. We'll come back and talk some more with Michael Pinard. And we welcome your calls or comments about any of this, 410-662-8780. Again, is our local number, toll-free, long-distance, good from anywhere in the country, 866-661-9309, and our email address, midday@wypr.org. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here with Michael Pinard from the University of Maryland School of Law, who's made a comparative study of Ferguson and Baltimore in terms of criminal justice, particularly as it affects people of color. And he did this, of course, in the wake of the death of Freddie Gray, was working on this piece before that, in the wake of the death of Michael Brown almost a year ago. It'll be a year ago this Sunday in Ferguson, Missouri. So we talked about, I think we should go back maybe to the beginning a mm-hmm. little bit about, you know, when people first get into the system, they're pulled into the system and get stuck right. in the system. I'm not sure everyone appreciates just how long it takes to shake your problems with the law
mm-hmm.
Once you get drawn in. You commit an offense, say a fairly minor drug offense, you do some time in prison.
Right.
You come out, you get probation, maybe,
mm-hmm.
or you don't get probation. You get paroled,
right.
Released after maybe 2 or 3 years of serving a sentence, but it goes on from there.
Right. And so, and we've talked about this in the past. And so, you know, any time a person leaves, well, first of all, in Maryland, every time a person leaves court, regardless of what the end result of the case is, conviction, non-prosthetic, et cetera, that person has a criminal record, right? That person has a criminal record. Employers could access it. Landlords could access it. They may not know that a non-process is a non-conviction. They may not know that a stat is a non-conviction, or they may not care. So even I want to be clear that even when a person leaves court without a conviction, that interaction with the criminal justice system can hold that person back. Obviously, with a conviction, the stakes are higher. There are a range of these so-called collateral consequences, which are the extra legal penalties that attach to conviction. So they can relate to public housing, they can relate to certain forms of employment, they can relate to voting, public benefits depending on a particular jurisdiction, right? Serving on a jury. And so these are the legal penalties that attach. And then we have the informal penalties that attach. That is, I'm an employer and I just don't want to hire you. I'm not bound by any law, but I don't want to hire a person with a criminal record. I don't want to hire a person who's been through the criminal justice system. So these are among the range of issues that the vast majority of people in the criminal justice system can expect to confront.
For those of us here in Maryland, could you run down offender funded justice for us? Do I have that right? OFJ, I'm going to call it. I remember that phrase.
So offender funded justice really deals with, you know, across the country, people who are in the criminal justice system have to pay certain fees for certain services or even related to certain penalties. So, for instance, in some jurisdictions, like in Maryland, right, we have probation and parole, which I believe is $50 a month. You have the article from the New York Times that you talked about. There's an article from the New York Times that appeared this Monday about that featured a woman in Maryland who had a drunk driving charge and the penalties, the money that she had to pay to get treatment, the penalties for certain programs that she had to be in. She couldn't really keep up with all these payments. And so across the country, individuals have to pay, right, to be in the criminal justice system.
And you're indebted to the state, right?
You're indebted to the state.
That doesn't go away. That's like any other debt.
So you have court-related debt. You have penalty-related debt. People can't afford to keep up with it. You know, civil judgments, civil actions could ensue as a result. Some of it's been privatized where they have private companies that go after your debts. And so, you know, yes, it's again.
Okay. So respond to the person who says, Michael, well, that's too bad. I'm sorry. You got in trouble. That's too bad.
Right.
This is all part of this is the cost. You know, if you can't do the time or if you can't pay, don't do the crime. So what do you say to that person?
We know, you and I know, that the overwhelming majority of people who are in the criminal justice system are flat broke. Flat broke, right? And so when we set up mechanisms where you get one avenue of justice because you could pay and one where you can't pay, then we have problems of constitutional magnitude, right? So we have to be sensitive to the fact that people are flat broke and that these additional penalties or payments, right, can stand in the way of them moving past their experience with the criminal justice system. That is, they can undermine public safety. People are scared. People live in the shadows of the criminal justice system. People feel like, I can't pay. There's no way I could conform. There's no way I could, you know, abide by my sentence. And people are scared, right? And so, you know, it's just not a fair system where we expect people to go into this amount of debt or any debt whatsoever as a result of interfacing with the criminal justice system.
You know, in my experience, the last, especially the last 10 years or so, focused on the subject of offender reentry, people trying to get out of the system, get a job, get on with their lives, and not return to our prisons at a cost of, 28,000, rising, maybe it's 30-something thousand by now per year per inmate. For every one person who says, well, I don't care, that's too bad, you know, expressing the sentiment I just played with you, there's 8, maybe 10 people who understand that you just can't have this revolving door.
And, you know, look, to the people who
that's in my experience. No, it's completely anecdotal. It's not based on any survey.
No, but also, you know, I think that in terms of the advocacy, maybe there are other ways that we can get people to care. That is, we need to tell more stories about people who really, again, mostly the gut reaction in thinking about the criminal justice system is when we think about the violent offenses, not sort of the everyday offenses that flood our courts and the everyday stories that flood our courts as well. And so the problem with the system as well is we don't allow these individual stories to air. You know, you're going to any court, snap of the fingers, people are in and out. And no one knows the significance of what just happened to that person. So we have to find other ways to tell these stories as well.
Does it cost you to be on probation?
Yes, it does cost you to be on probation.
Do you have to pay to see a probation agent?
I believe, it's different states have different, you know, costs. I believe in Maryland it's about $50 a month. Right, and you can have it waived. I mean, if you can't afford it, it can be waived. And we passed a bill a couple years ago in Annapolis that told people up front, right, more transparent about their inability to pay, and they can still be on probation. There are exemptions, but yes, there is a fee.
You've teamed up with a woman named Sharon Cole,
right,
who is from the Office of the Public Defender in Maryland, and you've made presentations over at Healthcare for the Homeless, where you often find people with criminal records who have been out of prison for a while.
Right.
What do you do there? What's the presentation you make?
So Sharon Cole is a long time community-oriented, you know, one of my heroes with the Office of the Public Defender. And so what we've been doing for the last several years at this point is around once a month, she does a presentation on warrants. She talks to warrants. She talks to people about warrants, 40,000 warrants in Baltimore City. We go around the room, how do warrants mess people up? We talk about warrants and what they mean. And then she provides resources. That is, if you have a warrant, you could speak with the Office of the Public Defender. Let's try to find a way to deal with the situation. And then I talk about expungement. You might know that my clinic, we do a lot of expungement work. We do most of our work out of Mount Diamond Mall. And I talk about, just give an overview of the expungement process, but then talk about the interaction between warrants and expungement, right? So, for instance, what I say is, look, if I meet somebody in an expungement workshop and they have a warrant, right, I want to make, this person needs to clear up the warrant before we deal with the expungement. Because Number one is, look, I don't want to make a person worse off. I file some expungement petition, all of a sudden, everyone knows this person has a warrant. But also, the warrant usually is an open case, which can stand in the way of expungement. So what we're trying to do is really deal as holistically as possible with the range of criminal record issues that we see in our respective practices.
Aren't people,
and provide information about that.
Aren't people, if I knew I had a warrant on me, okay,
right.
So maybe I wanted to get on with my life, but mm-hmm. I found a couple of people wouldn't hire me because they had an outstanding warrant,
mm-hmm.
but I managed to find some other job.
Correct.
Maybe a part-time job, maybe
right.
a temp job. I'm
right.
getting by.
Right.
I don't want to go down to the Central District
right.
and say, hey, there's a warrant out for
right.
me. This is my name. Here's my number.
Right.
Right? I mean, aren't most people reluctant to do that?
I don't know. Many people are. Many people are not. So here's the thing, right? You are one rolling stop away from being arrested with that warrant popping up, right? All it takes is, you know, something you're not thinking about for that warrant to pop up. Now,
mm-hmm.
look, if we have 40,000 warrants in Baltimore City, chances are some people can live the rest of their lives and that warrant won't come back to haunt them. But they can live scared, right? They can live a hidden life where they're scared of every step that they take. They may not drive because of their warrant, right? So there's that. But also I find that some people just want peace of mind. That is, I've moved past this circumstance in my life. I really want to clear this up because this is not even the person who I am anymore. I'm way past this circumstance.
Hmm.
And I really want to have this opportunity to move past this situation. It's holding me back. Maybe it's not holding me back from getting this job, but it's certainly holding me back in terms of how I live my daily life, how I interact with my children, right? There's all of that as well.
410-662-8780. If you'd like to join my conversation with Michael Pinard, visiting us today from the University of Maryland School of Law, where he's a professor. Let's take a couple of calls, Michael. Alan in Baltimore, you're on the line with us. Go right ahead, Mike. Alan, go right ahead.
Yeah, well, actually, I think it's a total travesty of justice to have any amount of your general budget outlined as being from fines, because that means that the fines have nothing, collecting the fines no longer have anything necessarily to do with crime or law, but have to do with budgeting. And that as soon as you have, you know, this as part of the budget, then you automatically have an unjust situation. And, you know, and what happens, of course, is that, and I think it's very constitutionally situation, that if you have these kinds of fines that are created because they have a budget necessity, you now have debtor's prison.
Correct.
Coming back.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Thank you, Alan. That's what it amounts to.
So, you know, look, it's we could have a broader issue here about policing, but a parallel is quotas. Right. So if I'm a police officer and I have to arrest a certain number of people per month, that's not really about, you know, justice. That's about me having to hit my numbers. And I think you can draw an analogy with these fines. That is, when you have a dedicated budget item saying we're going to collect these millions of dollars this year. Right. Then certainly, you know, it's the cart before the horse, if you will. It's the cart driving the horse. And maybe I'm mixing up that that analogy. But certainly that's what you're creating. You're creating debtors' prisons where people are now being returned to jail. They go to jail, right, because they cannot pay a certain fine, which is, by the way, unconstitutional. But with that said.
But do we do that in Maryland? Haven't we made some reforms, especially when it comes to child support, for instance?
Oh, no. We've made a lot of reforms in Maryland. So now in Maryland, the law used to be, well, put it like this. When a person goes to prison, right, if the sentence is 18 months or more, the person has to be told that he or she can waive his child support obligation, right? You fill out a form and it's done, or it's done automatically. If it's 18 months or less, we still have the issue of having to inform people. But that was a major reform. So certainly, yes. In this regard, Baltimore is not like Ferguson, but the underlying conditions, you know, are very, very similar.
One reform we made in Maryland, or the legislature did anyway, was we passed a law allowing convicted felons to vote, right?
We've had a series.
Maryland
was one of these places, you know, a decade ago, we were one of the few states left that were disenfranchising people for life. We did a we passed a couple of laws in the late 2000s. And so right now, the law is that when a person completes his or her sentence, at the moment he or she completes the sentence coming out of prison, is on parole or probation, he or she can vote.
So you
that's
have
the law.
But you have to complete your parole or probation conditions, right?
We used to have a waiting period. It was a 3-year waiting period after you completed the sentence. Then they amended the law to say there's no more waiting period, but you still have to wait to finish probation and parole.
Okay. And the legislature took one more step this year toward making this go away almost completely. Delegate Corey McCray from the 45th District of Maryland here in Baltimore City is on the line with us, Michael Pinard, to talk about, well, an event that's happening today that relates to this. Of course, today, the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights
Act.
Delegate McCray, thank you for joining us.
Dan, thanks for giving me the opportunity to be on.
Yes. When I say the legislature took another step forward with this, the law that passed this year did what?
Well, House Bill 980 would have let our friends, our neighbors, ex-felons have the opportunity to vote immediately after prison. They're the ones that care about education, they care about transportation, they care about housing, but we always see that they're left away from the table, so they don't have a seat at the table on so many critical issues that affect them so drastically.
So if you're on probation or parole, you still can't vote. Right.
At this time, because the governor vetoed House Bill 980, which passed the Senate, which passed the House, that did not come true for a lot of 40,000 folks across the state of Maryland that don't have the right to vote right now will not be able to participate in an election because the governor vetoed that bill.
Did the governor Hogan say why he vetoed this? Did he give a statement at the time?
He gave a statement, but the statement to me read that he's okay with the way it is right now. And I think that that's unsatisfactory, especially representing District 45, which has a high number of folks that's been incarcerated or currently on parole or probation, and with such dire issues in reference to housing, which dire issues in reference to transportation. You saw with the red line, you see we're having a conversation about buses, such dire in reference to employment, in reference to the Second Chance Act. How can we let elections be decided by and just this past election cycle, we had an election in Baltimore County that was decided by less than 50 votes. We had an election in Prince George's that was decided by less than 3 votes. We had an election in Southern Maryland which was decided by less than 75 votes. So, Dan, the question that I ask is how can we leave 40,000 people out of the electoral process for the whether it's their municipality, their state, or the federal government?
I've tried to understand the reason for this beside being a continuation of a penalty for committing a crime, a felony, why it's so punitive. I'm not sure I understand the value of this anymore. I don't.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you as well.
Why do we keep people from voting if they've served their time? Okay, they're on parole, probation, so they have to continue to, you know, fulfill that obligation. But they're out here trying to, you know, make a go of life again. Right? Get a job, maybe?
Right. Well, you know, there's also a broader narrative involved. So you mentioned
pay taxes, excuse me.
And so there's also a broader narrative. That is, so the Voting Rights Act was signed by President Johnson 50 years ago today, and we know that there are a number of hurdles to voting. And so there's litigation all around the country with voter IDs and closing down polls and tightening up the pre-registration periods. And disenfranchisement has always been one of the provisions that looms particularly large in this arena through the history of our country. And so it's, you know, through the history, it's very much race-based. And now, so it's race-based, it's also very political, right? And so the political lines are quite clear on this. But there's a moral argument. There's a dignity argument. That is that while we allow for people to have second chances, which is a big bipartisan issue these days, right, that we should, and by the way, there are some Republicans, right? Rand Paul is a person. These folks feel that folks should be able to vote as soon as we want them to be able to vote. But, you know, the issue comes down to politics. It comes down to race. It comes down to dignity. And 60% of Marylanders who can't vote because of disenfranchisement are African American.
Delegate McCray, you have an event today. You want to mention that on the air?
Yep. So we're meeting down at McAlden Square, 5 o'clock, 5:30. We're going to march to the Thurgood Marshall statue, and like you said, just raise and amplify the voices of the voiceless right now. And it's just like Mr. Pernard said, that these folks pay taxes. These folks are our family, they are our neighbors, our friends. If you live in Baltimore City, I'm sure that you can know one person that's been convicted, that's been arrested, that's on parole, that's on probation. And I think that it's a conversation about the have and the have-nots. Right now, we have administration that's trying to protect the stuff for the people that's winning. And then we have those people that's trying to get a seat at the table, Dan. They're trying to get they're trying to be in a conversation about transportation. They're trying to get reliable transportation. They have kids that are in the education system, in the public school system. They're trying to get employment. They have employment. They're trying to get good wages for employment. This is 40,000 people that we're talking about. These are real lives. They live in our neighborhoods. They're right next door to us and care about the same issues that we care about. Why are they not have the ability to access to the ballot box?
Delegate Corey McCray of the 45th District here in Baltimore. So this is tonight, 5:30 p.m. It starts at McKeldin Square, which is at Pratt and Light, and then there's a march just a couple of blocks down the street to the Thurgood Marshall statue near the federal courthouse.
Yes, sir.
And this is a notice from Communities United and Delegate McCray. Thank you very much for being on the show with us today.
Thank you again, Dan.
410-662-8780. This is the Midday Show. Dan Roderick's here with Michael Pinard from the University of Maryland Law School. A short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back to the Midday Show. You're welcome to give us a call and join our conversation with Michael Pinard from the University of Maryland Law School. Looking at Ferguson, looking at Baltimore, comparing the two in terms of the criminal justice system. Fran in Baltimore is joining us now. Fran, you there?
Yes, I'm here, Dan.
Yes, what did you want to say, Fran?
I just wanted to say, rather than have fines for our youth, would it be a better idea, and I wonder what Mr. Pinard. I wondered what he'd think about this. Could we develop as a city some form of community service where these boys, rather than have all these horrible threats to them that they'll go to court and pay severe fines, could we have them doing stuff in the community? I mean, this is a city full of weeds, trash, rats. Could we get them really helping to clean up the city? And I feel as though the trade-off for that is we don't have all the expense of the court system. We don't frighten these boys to take a path of hardening them. They might take a better path. Also, I feel as though if they turn up and their attitude is seen to be changing, maybe they could be offered education, training, job opportunity, rather than go back and recommit the crime.
It just so happens we have an email echoing what Fran says. This is from Walt in Baltimore County, similar to Fran. He says, I think community service should be offered in lieu of paying fines and court costs, maybe at the rate of $10 or so per hour of community service. Community service not only serves the community, but it can enhance a person's sense of well-being and may be a route to work. And Michael Pinard, I have heard judges in district court sentence people, at least in part, to community service, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, community service is a very common sentence. And so, you know, look, we should be thinking about sentences that, I mean, I agree with the sentiment that we don't want people wedded and stuck to the criminal justice system. We also want to find pathways out of the criminal justice system for individuals. And we could do that before a sentence. We could do that at the outset of the criminal justice system, or we could do it, you know, at the tail end.
Let me ask you about zero tolerance policing, because this has come up a number of times since the death of Freddie Gray.
Right.
Came up, especially when former mayor and governor Martin O'Malley appeared on North Avenue shortly after the riot of April 27th and was heckled by some people who recalled the days when he was mayor.
Right.
We came out of a decade in the 1990s when we saw homicide rates like we're seeing now in Baltimore this year,
in,
you know, more than 300 per year. He ran for mayor. O'Malley did, pledging to make the city safe, to get that number down, to make the city generally safer. And he brought in this policy of, right. And we ended up having mass arrests of right. people, 100,000 arrests in right. a couple of years there. So during his time as mayor, and in looking back on it, you know, a lot of people at the time thought, well, yeah, I'm glad O'Malley's doing this because we got to do this, right? We got to get this under control. All these years later, we're looking back and saying, well, it was too harsh. It went too far. Mm-hmm. Even a couple of former police commissioners have mm-hmm. said this about mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. They didn't say so at the time, but they said it mm-hmm. in retrospect. What are your thoughts on it?
So the thing with these arrests also were that the state's attorney at the time was saying many of these arrests, you know, these charges are you know.
Oh, they didn't even bring the cases.
They didn't even bring the cases. Yeah. And so you had a lot of people who were released without being charged. And so people were just basically brought into the criminal justice system, spent a few hours in central booking, and then were spit out, essentially, you know, back on the street. And I mean, look, I'm not going to say anything other people haven't said. The issue with it was that we have mass criminalization around some minor offenses on records. And in Maryland, we know that, again, all these records are available on the internet. Right. So any one of us can look up anybody's record and you see it saturated with these types of offenses. People cannot move past them. So part of it is just fully understanding what the weight of the interaction with the criminal justice system really means. And certainly looking back, we could see what zero tolerance policing has done in Baltimore City as well as other jurisdictions. And, you know, there were some lawsuits and there were some settlements involved, and we technically got rid of zero tolerance policing as a legal mechanism.
Agreed not the city agreed not to use that right, strategy right, anymore.
Not to use that strategy anymore. But yeah. again, you know, I think that when people talk about, you know, the need to sort of bring people into minor offenses, number one, what does that do in communities in terms of their trust of the criminal justice system? There's this sort of realization that I'm next, right? That's my fate. Right. When I see everybody around me going through the system, that is my fate. And so, therefore, it brings deterrence down.
That's part of growing up. That's part of living in Baltimore.
It brings deterrence down. Right. There's less respect for law enforcement and the courts. But also, again, these records are now splashed in infamy on the Internet and forever hold them back. Right. So I don't really know that people understand the impact and the import of a criminal record for minor offenses. I'm not sure that people understand the weight of what these things really mean.
There's a balance there, is there not, though, between, you know, there's civil rights, individual rights, and desire
safety.
To be safe.
And,
right?
and community safe. That's,
and the cops are right in the middle of this.
That's a big deal, right? And so, absolutely, right? That's about community safety. It's about quality of life for these communities. But that's why these issues are broader than the criminal justice system. See, the issue is we want the criminal justice system to resolve all these issues. Right. But we have education. We have community disinvestment. We have joblessness. We have concentrated poverty. We have food deserts. Yeah. Right. These are all issues that have to be addressed. We should not be relying solely upon the criminal justice system to work out all these issues.
Alan in Baltimore County, our next caller here on the Midday Show. Welcome.
Hello. Can you hear me OK?
Yeah, you're fine, Alan. Go right ahead.
OK, we can have a honest disagreement sometimes about what constitutes bad policing, but most of us recognize that when we see it, it amounts to either fundraising, raising revenue through fines, or it amounts to a contrived reason to pull somebody over, like a lane change violation or something. Those like me who are upper middle class, white, privileged, for us it's just an inconvenience, and most of us deal with that by just writing a check. I'm proposing instead, I'm going to court, I've already called the officers, supervisors, I have developed a very low tolerance for bad policing, and I'm going to make it well known throughout from the police to the courts, because if we don't stand up for the working poor, who can't take the time off to go to court, who can't afford the fine, if we don't stand up for them, who will?
How are you going to do that, Alan?
I've already contacted the police departments, supervisor, and talk to the precinct captain, and of course they say, well, if you think this is a cheesy action, they'll take it to court. Well, I'm taking it to court, and I'm not going there to appeal. I can afford the fine, and I don't have any points against my license. I'm not going there to get on my knees and ask for lower points and lower fine. I'm going there to give them a piece of my mind, and that's the only current satisfaction I can get out of that. I also want to take it to the political realm, so I appreciate the contacts that the gathering momentum to say enough of this let's just call it bad policing. That's all it is.
Or bad policy that the police have to carry out, right?
Look, I think one of the huge issues, again, it takes, you know, a Michael Brown to be killed for us to figure out what's going on in Ferguson. It takes Tamir Rice to be killed in Cleveland for us to figure out what's going on in Cleveland, right? It takes, you know, any number of people we could think of, right? Akai Gurley in Brooklyn, New York, or Eric Garner in Staten Island. And, I think what we could all do, so if the question is what can people do to push back on these issues, part of it is really trying to see these issues as they are. That is becoming more worldly. It's almost like becoming more neighborly. It's becoming more worldly around these issues.
Let's take the felon voting thing.
Correct.
All right, look at that for a minute. Yeah. Why? Why would you not want somebody who's,
right,
you know,
right,
served their time in prison, come out, be able to vote again?
What's, yeah,
you, and, tell me, argue that one for me. You think this should be part of the penalty? You don't get to take part in the system?
Yeah.
For a while after you've been in prison?
But from an advocacy point, what I would say people should do is you need to contact those organizations that have been dedicated fighting for whatever issue, right, you now want to be attached to, and contact those organizations and find out how you could be of some use,
yeah,
right? It could be that you're right. You need to stand up in Annapolis and testify about how these issues are impacting you. It could be that if you live, you know, in Roland Park, you need to take a ride through Sandtown, Winchester, and figure out what's really going on in that community. And, you know, one of the things that strikes me about all these issues across, you know, pick your jurisdiction, but let's take Baltimore, for instance, is this, you know, look, it's a small city, and people live completely different lives, completely separate lives, completely different conditions. And, you know, people kind of don't know or don't want to know what other folks are struggling with on a daily basis. And so getting to know each other, I think, is a first step.
If you're an employer,
mm-hmm,
you have an opportunity to make a difference in somebody's life.
Absolutely.
The next offender.
Absolutely.
Gary in Bel Air, go right ahead. Hi.
Okay. You guys are really, as an ex-offender, I'm going to tell you something. You're barking up the wrong tree. Here's my opinion, and then you take it for what it's worth. When you're on probation or parole, you're still technically incarcerated. You're serving your sentence, and they let us know that. You know, every month we have to report.
Mm-hmm.
But that's long gone. But here's what we gotta fight. If you want to help the ex-offenders, if you really want to help them get back in the community, let's set a time frame up for them to complete their sentence. When do you pay your debt to society? When is your debt fully paid off? Let me give you an example, and I'm talking from personal experience. A man makes a mistake 25 years ago, does everything by the book since then, lives like an angel, so to speak. Not so much the speeding ticket. 25 years later, he's still paying for that penalty, for that mistake. Every time he goes to apply for a job, have you ever been? Have you ever been convicted? You know, it's a lifetime sentence. I don't care what your crime was. You're going to pay for it for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have improved the expungement laws in Maryland, have we not?
So, no, you raise great points, and I don't disagree with anything. Let me say, though, in terms of incarcerated, you make an interesting point between being incarcerated and not incarcerated. You know, Maine and Vermont, people in prison can actually vote. I mean, you know, we have this whole discussion about when people should resume the right to vote. I don't necessarily start with after a person completes a sentence. I believe people incarcerated also have the dignity and also should also have a say in the affairs of their community.
Should you suffer for a crime you committed 25 years ago? Shouldn't you get that expunged and then feel no obligation to answer that question if someone asks you?
Absolutely, right? And we could draw lines about what types of offenses, and there's some offenses that are more serious than others, but there is research out there, all right? And I can give you the names of the folks, but essentially, once you go a certain number of years crime-free, regardless of what your conviction was, you are as likely to commit a new crime as any of us who's never been in a criminal justice system has before. So that is, you're as safe as any of us. And so I think that should stand for something. So I have no problem with that.
Michael Pinard is a professor at the University of Maryland Law School. He's been our guest in this hour of the show, talking about an article that appears in the Howard Law Journal, Poor, Black, and Wanted in quotes, Criminal Justice in Ferguson and Baltimore. Thank you very much, Michael. Enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you, as always.
And
learned
some things. Thank you, folks. Please stay tuned. We have a second hour of Midday just ahead after the news here at the top of the show and after we get some lunch from Eddie's of Roland Park, providing lunch for our guests today.